Hello, I'm Mark Stein, and welcome back. On our way to our conversation, I just want to do a very quick remembrance. It would be longer if we weren't in the middle of a fun drive, and we knew all the time we can get. But we lost two great South Dakotans in the last week, and I just want to remember them for what they've done for this country. George McGovern, who, of course, ran for President of the United States in 1972, stood up for what he believed, a man who was a bombardier during World War II, and said enough to war, enough to sending young people to war and having old men make money. He lost to Richard Nixon, as we all remember, or we may or may not remember. And he always stood for what was right. He was a prairie populist, and I had the pleasure of working for his campaign in 1972, turning what were once George Wallace precincts into George McGovern precincts, going door to door, and it was an honor to work for a man like that. We also lost Russell Means, one of the founders of the American Indian Movement, who I knew well, who is a friend, who took care of my family when they were in need in L.A., who was a man who stood up for the Indian people in this country, stood against oppression, was imprisoned, and never stopped fighting for justice in America. And he died at 72 years old of esophageal cancer. So I want to very quickly remember both Russell Means and George McGovern. Maybe later in the week we'll take snippets from conversations with them we've had in the past and air them for you. We didn't have time this week just because of the fun drive and everything else going on. So now we want to turn to our conversation here, and we continue that theme in many ways because this is a book. It's a book that was written called Round and Round Together, and it was written by Amy Nathan, taking a merry-go-round ride into the civil rights movement. It is her history of what happened in Baltimore in the Gwin Oak Park demonstrations and integrated that amusement park. But it's more than that. This really, I was really shocked as I read the book. It's such a thorough kind of history that I lived through of the civil rights movement in the early 60s and late 50s in Baltimore, of the Congress for Racial Equality and the Civic Interest Group. So she joins us here by phone. We're also joined in studio here by Charles Mason, who is now a retired parole officer who recently worked for the city to coordinate volunteer programs for senior citizens. But he was an official of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, that organized and led the protests at Gwin Oak Amusement Park from 1955 to 1963. And he was 25 years old in 63, recently out of Morgan State College then, not university, and was on those demonstrations. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio, Charles. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And our other guest today is James Crockett. James Crockett is somebody I've known for a long time. He participated in the protests at Gwin Oak and many other demonstrations. But a bit of history about Jim Crockett. He was a pioneer. From 1954 to 1964, he was one of the early African-Americans to be in our Baltimore City Fire Department. He was a firefighter, a man who didn't run from fire. He ran into the buildings to save lives. And he then became chairman of the fire board for 10 years?
Yes.
Right? He was head of CHAP for like 13 years, house preservation in this community. He runs Crockett Realty. He has been a civic leader of this community and a man I greatly admire and respect, and it's just an honor to have him in the studio with us. And Jim Crockett, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark, for being here.
And folks, and Amy, welcome. Good to have you with us as well, obviously. It's your book.
Glad to be here.
So, Amy, talk very quickly, though. Let's just jump into this. Why you picked this piece of history and how you wrote such a thorough history of this place. I mean, this is really having me someone who lived through it, was arrested in it, seeing a book that really tells that story. I've not seen one that does the job that your book did, I think.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, well, I came across, I grew up in Baltimore. I went to Western High School, and I actually lived not far as a child from Gwin Oak Amusement Park, out in Hunting Ridge, out Edmondson Avenue. But I came across a brief mention of the fact that Gwin Oak dropped segregation on the same day as the March on Washington,
right.
And on that day, this little child was the first African-American child to go on a ride at the park, and she rode on the merry-go-round. And I read that in the book, Here Lies Jim Crow, by Fraser Smith's book.
Good book.
Yeah, that is a wonderful book. And I usually write books for kids, and so I thought, well, this would be a great story for kids. So, but then as I started doing more research on it, I saw that the story really could be expanded to really serve as kind of a case study in how a protest movement worked and how a civil rights protest movement worked and developed over the years and how it fit into what was going on elsewhere in the country. And then when I discovered that the merry-go-round that a little girl rode was now at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., well, then it just seemed like there were so many coincidences and ramifications to it that it just seemed like a really interesting book that I was willing to devote all those years to learning more about. And I grew up in Baltimore, and I didn't know any of this history. So it's been an education for me.
And this is an amazing book, I must tell you, because it's the history, it's our history of this city, our history in this community. And Charles Mason, talk about CORE at the very beginning, the Congress of Racial Equality, and how it got into the Gwin Oak issue, and just the beginnings of that organization here in the city that was written about in this book, Round and Round.
Well, CORE was a complete grassroots organization located in a little office on North Avenue, right west of Bentlow Street.
In the basement, if I remember
in
correctly.
In the basement. That was a real estate office during the day and CORE office at night. And I became interested in CORE because I was having a problem dealing with the segregation and discrimination in Baltimore. And I was working with a fella, John Burley, who passed last year. And he saw that my frustration was boiling over to the danger point dealing with discrimination in Baltimore. And I really mean that. And he said, there's somebody I want you to meet. So I said, okay. And I knew I was going to, you know, big hall, marble front and big steps. So he came, picked me up one evening, and he said, we're going up to meet Walter. And we drove up North Avenue, and I was familiar with that area, but I didn't know any grand halls that we were going to meet Walter. But then he stopped and he parked, and we walked up a little walkway. And duck your head, duck my head, and I went downstairs, and it was a little table. Wasn't very elegant, but there was a table, and there were people there talking. And they were talking and talk that I liked, and I stayed. And that was my beginning.
You're talking about Walter
Carter,
of course, and who was just one of the most amazing human beings that ever walked the planet Earth.
You knew he was a true warrior, and mm-hmm. you knew that you could trust him and follow him and go the right way.
And Jim, I mean, we only have 2 minutes, so we have to take a break, but I want you to kind of talk about how you, I mean, I know you've always been a fighter for justice, but how you ended up in the Civil Rights Movement here in Baltimore.
I ended up in the Civil Rights Movement in 1947. I had an interracial basketball team. They could not play in the recreation centers in the city of Baltimore. And we went up to Beth Tefillah Synagogue on Garrison Boulevard.
Right.
They had a basement gym. We played there. We played in Sharp Street Memorial Church's community house. We went to Philadelphia, Washington, New York, and we played around the United States on the Eastern Seaboard.
You had an interracial basketball team in 1947.
1947.
In Baltimore.
In Baltimore. Now, this was also connected with the tennis match out at Drury Hill Park on the clay courts. I was out there with the people that got arrested, and we filed a case, and Judge Thompson was the federal judge that heard the case. He knew me, and during the hearings, he would slip up. He would say, well, Jim, you know, and then he would say, oh, Mr. Crockett. He would change his tune. So at the end, he told me, he says, you did not have a financial interest in this. Had any of the players filed this same case, we would have rendered in their favor. Mm. But you were not discriminated, and that's what happened.
We're going to take a very brief break, talk about WEA, your public radio station. We're going to come back to Amy Nathan, who wrote the book Round and Round Together, taking a merry-go-round ride into the Civil Rights Movement, and our two guests in studio, two of our civil rights warriors and legends in the studio with us, Charles Mason and Jim Crockett. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are about to continue our conversation with Amy Nathan, who's written this incredible book, Round and Round Together, Taking a Merry-Go-Round Ride into the Civil Rights Movement. Charles Mason is with us, who was one of the leaders of the Congress of Racial Equality here in Baltimore from 1955 to 1963. 63, who had finished being a student at Morgan University, 25 years old, a civil rights warrior in this town, along with Jim Crockett, who helped break the color barrier in our fire department, among many other things in his life, and men who ran into buildings, not away from them. 410-319-80. No, wrong thing. Yes, you can do that. You can make that pledge right now. But anyway, back to the conversation. One of the things I looked in here for when in this book Amy, and then I want to have our two guests here talk about this, is you write about CIG, the Civic Interest Group, which was the group that I was part of as a young boy, which is made up of mostly younger Morgan University students, and the older group that was part of the Congress for Racial Equality. They're a little bit older, for the most part. And there was a rivalry, as you write about in the book, but this intense cooperation as well.
Right, right. It was the impatient energy of the young people that sort of propelled the older people along to become a little bit more active. And I found that just a really fascinating story. The interaction between the younger people who just weren't ready to wait any longer.
And there's a great quote in the book from you, Charles Mason, about that time and those two groups.
The thing was, one group would want to move in this direction, the other one wanted to go in that direction. And sometimes the older folks would say, you know, this is not the time. You know, you've got to wait. You know, but we didn't want to wait for anything. You know, we weren't going to wait for anything. If anything, they would have to keep up with us. No, it's
right. I was so impressed that that Baltimore, you know, really led the way in a lot of things. Baltimore led the way in 1933 with this boycott, the "Don't Buy Where You Can't Work" boycott in the west side of the supermarkets on the North Avenue stores. And then led the way again in 1953 with the lunch counter sit-ins that way before they happened in North Carolina, the ones that got a lot more press attention. But and in both cases, it was young people that did this.
There's an interesting paragraph. I'll read it for our listeners, and I think this might be your quote, but let me read it. It's about the Civic Interest Group and CORE, and this really was true. You really caught the heart of what that period of time was like in fighting for civil rights in Baltimore. So the youngsters felt kind of felt they were too slow, the NAACP method, going to the mayors and the governors and the court. They said the courts were slow, recalled Judge Robert Watts, who was a great man in his own right. He noted that Lily Mae Carroll Jackson, who was one of the leaders of the NAACP among the scans of that incredible family in this town, the Mitchell family, felt hurt by the students' attitudes and didn't always like their tactics. But he added, she played a significant role in their movement. She supplied the lawyers. She gave the contributions. So often provided bail money so protesters could be released promptly after being arrested. Judge Watts noted that CIG and CORE didn't have any money, and every time they got locked up, who would they call? The NAACP. So, and that was true.
Strange, but true.
And I can remember Mrs. Jackson at the NAACP headquarters, which is right around the corner from CIG's headquarters. Would we walk down to the CIG headquarters, she would yell at us from out the window, stop smoking those cigarettes, tuck in your pants, tuck in that shirt. And we didn't have to pull up our pants, we already had our pants up, but she said, tuck in that shirt. So it was like different era, but that was all true.
Mark, you know, they had a lot of people that did not get any credit for this movement. One is Paul Robeson. Paul walked in picket lines here in Baltimore. I walked with Paul at the Ford Theater. And when he came to Baltimore, he could not stay in a hotel. So Dr. John E. T. Camper gave his bedroom up so that Paul Robeson, when he came to Baltimore, he'd have a place to stay. Wow. And that was in the 600 block of Cary Street. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot of ministers. And NAACP, the Urban League, CORE. These organizations had independent things that they fought for, and they would call each other if they needed help. And one of the main people in this movement was a fellow by the name of Walter Lively.
Walter Lively. Walter Lively. Right.
And Walter could muster a group of people to picket in 5 minutes, or he was just right there. So it was a wonderful movement.
I'm going to read a couple of things that come across Facebook, which is interesting. There were a couple things here. Judy Gunnery, who I think is the mother of one of my producers, writes in, Mark, I remember going to Gwin Oak with happy memories until we didn't. No explanations from my parents. What you probably surmise, I'm a white Jewish woman who grew up in the 50s, very early memories, and the 60s with much more clear memories. I do remember the last day of school report cards, fond memories, no memories of racial issues because we were not allowed to see it. And also another one that came in, on our Facebook page, the Mark Steiner page, comes from Michael Eugene Johnson, who's been a guest on the show many times and an old friend, and he'll be interested to hear as you know, because he says, and I know this, that he was one of the children who was detained on July 4th of 1963 with others. So, and Michael Johnson, who's an activist still to this day in this town. So, and that was it. People were out. They describe, that's all three of you describe for a moment, starting with you, Charles, and then go to the author and hear from Jim Crockett, what it was like, literally, on the stage, picketing to integrate Quinn Oak Park.
It was like a bizarre carnival festival activity, even though it was serious, because people had been in my apartment painting signs for days. I mean, there were stacks of signs. I lived in Walbrook Junction, and the morning of it, we had signs to transport. I mean,
lots of signs
to transport. And even though it was very serious and it was dangerous, I got a couple stitches in my head from someone who called me. I recognized the voice.
This was not a picnic.
Turned. No, it was.
No picnic.
But the thing is, at this point, I don't remember being in fear. It was like something I had to do. Now, if you could have convinced my mother of that, you know, she would give a little ceremony, a little prayer before I would leave, you know, but it was something we had to do. It was just, it was no procrastinating. It was no, we'll do it next week. We were going to do it now.
Yeah, and from what I learned by talking to people and reading, it was incredibly well organized. They had a sort of a training session and a prayer service first at Metropolitan Methodist Church, and everyone there got training in how to be nonviolent, so not respond to the different insults that would be shouted at them by the counter protesters. And then that was very well organized. Some people could just picket, and other people could decide that they were going to go in. Break the trespass law and be arrested, and then they had buses, you know, and they had worked out arrangements with the police so that the arrest could be handled well, not violently. So it was an incredible amount of pre-planning that went into this.
We have to take a very brief break. Okay, Charles.
The pre-planning was so intense that if you were on medication, we would have to decide whether you could go on a picket line, take your medication, or whether you would have to be a person that would not be arrested. Because we tried to cover all bases. We didn't want anybody in jail that needed medication that could cause a crisis for them. So we covered all bases. And when doing the training, you were called all of the names.
All of the names
that you would be called on the picket line.
We have to take a brief break to talk about WEA. We're going to come back to our guests. You just heard Charles Mason, Amy Nathan, who's written this incredible book, Round and Round Together, taking a merry-go-round ride into the Civil Rights Movement, the great Jim Crockett in the studio as well. And we'll be right back as soon as we finish talking about WEA. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are about to continue our conversation here with Amy Nathan, who's written the book, Round and Round Together, taking a merry-go-round ride into the Civil Rights Movement, her history of the Civil Rights Movement in Baltimore, built around the experience of what happened in the fight for the integrate Gwin Oak Park. We are joined also in studio by Charles Mason, who's a retired parole officer who recently worked for the city, coordinating volunteer programs for senior citizens, and was an official with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, during this era. Was arrested, was beaten, was jailed in the streets here in Baltimore, and was there as a young man just out of Morgan State College then. We're also joined in the studio by Jim Crockett. James Crockett, of course, is Crockett Realty, but he is more than that. He was a fireman here in Baltimore City from 1954 to 1964, was one of the African-American pioneers in that department, became chair of the fire board, and has become one of our leading citizens in this community and community activists. Good to have them all in the studio. We left off, we were going back around this what the experience was like. Amy spoke, Nathan spoke, Charles Mason spoke, but now Jim Crockett, talk from your perspective what that experience was like to be fighting to integrate places like Gwin Oak Park.
Mark, I don't want it to be in vain, but we have not learned much in this country. Martin Luther King, Paul Robeson, and the leaders were fighting for integration and voting rights. And this year, this month, this day, there are people, citizens of the United States, that are being denied their right to vote.
That's right.
So we haven't accomplished very much. In all of the fights that occurred, all of the deaths that occurred, we're still in the same boat that we were in 100 years ago. And it's really sad. There are a lot of worthy people here that walked in the picket lines, but I had an unusual job. Most of the kids that participated were young Jewish girls, and there had to be a point where the heads would sit down and talk. Now, when the heads got together to sit down and talk, there had to be an interruption to make them do what they were supposed to do. Well, these young girls would come to me and say to me, my mother said, I can get locked up. Now, in order to get locked up, I would say to them, you had to be dressed properly. The police department did not know how to handle girls. One would grab two legs, the other one grabbed two arms, the dress would fall down, and we would use that as the catalyst to get them to sit down and talk. They would say this, you would not want that to happen to your mother, to your wife, to your daughter, or anybody like that. So let's select five people from your side, five from our side. We'll schedule a meeting, and that's how they solved a lot of the problems.
So, and there's part of this book, I think, I just want to remember somebody, because it's in your book, and I remember this day well. April 23rd, 1963, a member of Baltimore's chapter of Corps was a white member, was a postman, was walking to Alabama to present a petition.
Bill Moore.
Who was killed on the road.
Right. It was a very sad time. I was at Bill's house the night when he left. Carolyn Stitt, who's deceased at this time.
Carolyn Stitt, sure.
Barbara, she would kill me. I can't remember Barbara's last name. And we were talking, and some of us were saying, you know, we should go with Bill. And Bill said something strange about it would be too dangerous for you because you might not be coming back or something. And the night that I heard of his the catastrophe that had befallen him, I woke up about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I started listening to one of the news stations, and I heard it, and I felt funny. And a little later on, when I worked for St. Ambrose Housing, was right down the street from Bill Moore's house, and I used to walk past there when I'd walk down to the drugstore on the corner to get lunch or, you know, whatever. And I thought about it. You know, it was like conversations that weren't completed. Because we talked of a lot of things. We talked about the days like 2012, we would have been working for Greenpeace because we would have had solved the race problem in America. You know, I guess that was a little utopian because as I look at the news now and as I delve into the politics, I see that nothing has changed. It has taken a different direction. And what really puzzles me is how you can hate an idea. It's just that it really disturbs me, you know, because it looks like we didn't do enough, where did we go wrong? It just amazes me. I think about it long and hard.
And I do remember that point where he was murdered, and it came in the same year that Shawna Goodman and Cheney were murdered.
Yep.
And other civil rights workers were murdered throughout the South. We know those three names, but there are many others who died in that struggle. And we don't always remember the several dozen people who were killed fighting for civil rights in that same year.
Mickey Schwerner was at the July 4th demonstration at Quin Oaks.
I was about to ask you to tell that story.
Yeah. So he was a Corps volunteer, and he was there. And the next year, you know, he was gone.
I'm really, we talk about what motivated you to do this book, but I'm curious what you walked away with from this book. What happened to you in finishing and writing this book?
Well, I got a, my parents wouldn't let me go to the March on Washington. They thought it would be too dangerous, and I wasn't yet independent enough to say I was going to go. And so I've always sort of held it against them and held it against myself that, you know, I was a coward and they wouldn't let me go. But then as I began to read what was going on, because I wasn't reading newspapers back then, and just what was actually going on, you know, about Bill Maher being killed and that, you know, Nazi protesters were threatening to go and disturb the March on Washington and all that. And then I began to see things more from my parents' perspective. So I've come to a feeling of less annoyance with them for having kept me. And also when I interviewed several other people for the book whose parents also wouldn't let them go, they were just teenagers also, go to the March on Washington. But I really do feel badly that I didn't go. So in a way, writing this book is sort of making up for my not having the courage of my convictions then, you know. So. But what I was really impressed with was how all these disparate groups who had different philosophies about how to end segregation, how to fight against it, you know, they put those differences aside when it counted and did work together. And sure, wish people would do that more today. You know, people would learn how to cooperate and work together to achieve a common goal. And we could all learn something from the way people acted back then in that one particular incident.
You know, it's funny when I look at these pictures in the book. I mean, I know people from this book and how young we all looked back then.
Yeah.
but you have this, you have a great picture of Walter P. Carter in here, chairman of CORE. Look at him and you see his daughter's face.
Jill.
Yeah. Do you see Jill Carter? Right. And you have this great little story that I'll read because you have this place, it's chock full of wonderful stories besides the kind of the power of this movement. Funny little tidbits like you wrote in here. Somebody who I remember, Billy Garner Brown, was one of the first blacks to graduate from a Baltimore private school in 1962 during her senior year at Park School. She went out to lunch with some white classmates who drove to a white coffee pot, not remembering she wouldn't be allowed inside. One girl suggested Billy pretend to be from Argentina. She tried to speak with a Spanish accent, but when the manager asked if she was from Puerto Rico, Billy answered by mistake in French, saying, "Oui." The manager didn't notice anything wrong and let her stay. After lunch, a white friend asked the manager if he ever served Negroes. "Absolutely not," he said. She replied, "Well, you just did." And the girls raced to the car and sped off back to school. But,
that's a great story.
It is a great story. And I think that kind of is juxtaposed by the what happened in July of 63 when violence occurred, really, and there was an angry mob at the Gwin Oak. The group was called the Fighting American Nationalists. Keep Gwin Oak White. Integration stinks. U.S. for whites, Africa for blacks. And the humor and the power of that moment, I think, is what you're kind of show us in this book, Amy.
Right. You know that we're going to be getting together with these two gentlemen on Saturday afternoon at the Reginald Lewis Museum and give them more chance to tell more of their reminiscences from those days at a program for family program at the museum, part of their Growing Up Afro exhibit.
That'll be phenomenal. So both of you going to be there?
Yes, we'll be there.
All right.
They're all going to be there. Plus another woman, a young woman who was 11 years old at the time in 1963, Lydia Wilkins, who went on an undercover mission at the park on the morning of the second protest in July 7th at the instigation of an Afro reporter, got her and her aunt to sort of slip into the park before the protest started. Wander around the park, go on some rides, and then come out and show that nothing terrible had happened to the park because they were there.
We have to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back to finish our conversation with our incredible guest here that we've been talking with, Amy Nathan, who wrote this book, Round and Round Together, taking America Round ride into the Civil Rights Movement and the two of those civil rights warriors themselves, Charles Mason and James Crockett.